From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the first battle in America's war with militant Islam. We talk with Mark Bowden about his new book, Guess of the Ayatollah. It tells the story of the Iranian hostage crisis based on interviews with students who took over the embassy, the Americans who were held hostage, members of the Carter administration, and the military personnel who were part of the failed rescue attempt. Bowden is best known as the author of Black Hawk Down. We'll talk about what went wrong in the attempt to rescue the American hostages in Iran. And TV critic David Bianculli has three new DVD box sets to recommend, showing TV's evolution from the 1950s on, Mr. Peepers, The Merv Griffin Show, and 6 Feet Under. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mark Bowden, describes the Iranian hostage crisis as the first battle in America's war with militant Islam. His new book, Guests of the Ayatollah, is about the 444-day crisis. It began on November 4, 1979, when Iranian students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, protesting the U.S. decision to allow the exiled Shah to come to America for medical treatment. The students took 66 Americans hostage and held most of them for the duration of the crisis. Bowden tells the story from several perspectives, including the students, the hostages, the Carter White House, and the military forces involved with the failed attempt to rescue the hostages. Mark Bowden is best known as the author of Black Hawk Down. He reported for the Philadelphia Inquirer for 20 years and is a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. This month's cover story is Bowden's article about the failed rescue attempt. Mark Bowden, welcome back to Fresh Air. Well, I want to focus on what was quite a turning point in the story of the hostage crisis, which is the failed rescue mission. At what point did President Carter decide to try a rescue mission?
It wasn't until March of 1980, which was, 5 months after the embassy was taken and the hostages were kidnapped. He was extraordinarily patient, I think, in his handling of this episode. And I think that, you know, there was a basic question involved when the embassy was taken and the Americans were taken hostage about how the United States should respond. Should the lives of those American diplomats in Tehran be the highest priority, their safety? Or is the importance of protecting American missions around the world, protecting the integrity of the United States internationally, should that be the highest priority? And should the hostages be somewhat expendable in the interests of asserting American influence and power? And I think Carter, in my opinion, to his credit, felt from the beginning that there should be no difference between those two missions, that the safety of the hostages was as important to him as preserving the integrity of the United States missions around the world. And I think, you know, a different president might have made a different choice, but that's what I think prolonged the handling of the crisis. He tried every diplomatic means at his disposal through the UN, through allies, back-channel negotiations with members of the provisional government, or I call it the provisional government. It was the government that they had in place before they set up a permanent one, all of which kept failing. Basically, the mullahs kept pulling the rug out from under whatever deal they struck, until finally Carter, by the end of March, was just beaten down by it, and he'd been humiliated a number of times, and he just was fed up.
When Carter decided to try a rescue mission, he called in Charlie Beckwith, who was the founder of Delta Force, which was pretty new. It was like, a year old or something?
Actually, coincidentally, Delta Force had just been through its certification exercise, which was a big display that they put on for leaders of the Pentagon and congressional leaders to sort of demonstrate their capabilities on the same day that the embassy was taken on November 4th of 1979. So they literally were just sort of cooling off after finishing this big exercise when they were informed to start planning a possible rescue mission to Tehran.
So what were the ground rules that President Carter wanted for this rescue mission, and what were the ground rules that Charlie Beckwith, the head of Delta Force, wanted?
Well, Beckwith, I think, would have been of the opinion that he wanted to be able to do whatever was necessary to make it successful. Carter, obviously, as president, had broader concerns. I mean, there were the dangers of igniting a larger war in the Middle East. You know, you could project all sorts of scenarios of a rescue force getting trapped in the city of Tehran and, you know, waking up in the morning, Americans would wake up and turn on their TV sets and there would be a small rescue force surrounded and trapped in the city of Tehran, surrounded by millions of angry Iranians. And, you know, so there were all sorts of possible, terrible, broader scenarios with this. And so Carter's was first and foremost very reluctant to attempt it because it was very risky and there was the possibility of it becoming something much worse. But also, you know, wanted to do it in such a way that it didn't make the situation worse.
He was also worried about killing Iranians. He didn't want Delta Force to use any kind of lethal force if there was a riot, if there was a kind of citizen uprising against the rescue attempt.
In fact, you know, one of his instructions was that he insisted that the men on Delta Force carry riot control devices with them, tear gas, rubber bullets or something of that order, so that their first response, if there was a large crowd in the streets that they encountered, would not be to open fire on them, but to sort of control the crowd. This, of course, was just ludicrous to the Delta Force guys. You're talking about a group of 130 men who were going to insert themselves into a city of about 5 million hostile people, try and rescue these hostages. If they got caught or surrounded by a crowd, the very idea that this small group is somehow going to be able to control the crowd, I mean, their feeling was, we need to get out of there as fast as we possibly can. And if we have to shoot some people to do it, then that's what we're going to do.
Would you give us just a kind of sketch of what the mission was supposed to look like, the rescue mission?
Well, the rescue force was going to fly initially to a rallying point in the desert, a couple hundred miles outside of Tehran, land, transfer the Delta Force, the Delta operators, onto helicopters. The helicopters were going to refuel at that point in the desert. Then the helicopters carrying the rescue force was going to fly to a hide site before sunrise the following day. They were going to hide throughout that day, the helicopters and the men. Then they were going to load up on trucks, Delta Force, drive through the city at night, raid the embassy grounds, get the hostages, blow a hole in the wall of the embassy grounds, take them across the street to a soccer stadium, strong point the soccer stadium, and start flying the helicopters in to evacuate them. At the same time that the embassy was being assaulted, a battalion of Rangers was going to take a small airport outside of Tehran, which was not heavily guarded, seize the airport so that large fixed-wing aircraft could fly in and land, load up all the hostages, all the rescue operators, and fly them all out of the country.
An incredibly ambitious undertaking.
Seriously. I mean, when you consider that in any military operation, you have to figure that things are going to go wrong. Anything with this many moving parts, everything had to be coordinated perfectly. It was pretty clear that it had a very small chance of success.
And things went wrong right from the start. The transport plane landed in the desert, and what happened?
Things always go wrong in military missions. And in this case, you know, they had scouted out the landing site, which was just a patch of empty desert with a kind of a dirt road angling through it, and had determined that there was almost no traffic on this road, that maybe once or twice a month, you know, a vehicle came down that road. Well, the first plane landed on the night of the first night of the mission, and before it even hit the ground, they saw two trucks driving down the road, and so they had to wait for those trucks to get out of the way. They landed. Rangers on the transport plane had to take off after the trucks in order to apprehend those people for fear that they would alert the authorities that a big American plane just landed in the desert. And as they were doing that, a busload of Iranian tourists drives right up through the middle of their staging area. So, I mean, it was just ridiculously improbable.
They fired on the truck?
They did. They gave chase to the trucks. There were two of them. It was a pickup truck and a larger truck. When they couldn't catch them, they fired a missile. I guess it was a handheld missile device that hit the truck, which turned out to be carrying fuel. So that truck went up created a huge bonfire in the middle of the desert. One of the men on that truck got out of it and jumped into the pickup, which took off, and they never did catch that one.
And what happened to the bus of passengers, the tourists?
The passengers, you know, their bus was stopped. The men shot into the engine block to stall the bus. They herded all the passengers off the bus, radioed back to headquarters, and the communications went all the way back to the White House to determine what do we do with these Iranians. And so Carter actually made the decision that they were going to load all the Iranian passengers on that bus back on the plane and fly them out of Iran, hold them during the following day when the men were hiding and then conducting the rescue mission. And when the mission was complete and the fixed-wing aircraft came back in to carry out the hostages and the rescue them, and they would bring the Iranians back to that airport and let them all go.
And then at the same time, you have like a fleet of, what, 8 helicopters who are flying through the skies, and there turns out to be like a sandstorm in the sky.
Right.
It's a phenomenon, I guess, in that part of the world, phenomenon that it sounds like they weren't prepared for.
They weren't. I mean, it was called, they call them an haboob, and it's basically the sand in the Iranian desert is a very fine powder, and sometimes you get these vertical columns of air pressure that will pull up and basically create a vertical cloud of dust. It's such fine dust that it's not a problem for planes, and it would be very rare for helicopters to be traveling, you know, hundreds of miles across the Iranian desert. So really, it's an issue that hadn't come up all that much. The pilots on the fixed-wing aircraft that flew in initially flew right through the two haboobs, and it was just to them a curiosity. But the helicopters, when they got in the middle of it, suddenly they couldn't see. They couldn't see each other. They couldn't see the ground. They couldn't see the mountains in front of them. It was smothering the engines. The heat rose inside of the aircraft. The pilots were flying with night vision goggles, which tend to make a person dizzy anyway. And so suddenly, you know, they're now fighting against almost zero visibility. It became a real trial, not to mention the beating up the machinery of the helicopter, this fine dust getting into all the gears and everything else. So it proved to be the undoing of the mission, actually.
Yeah, so what was the fate of the helicopters?
Well, initially there were 8 helicopters. One of the helicopters was, the rotor was hit by something that cracked it, and that's a terminal failure for a helicopter. If you continue to fly with a crack in the rotor, it could fly apart and you would crash. So they set that helicopter down, got off, got on one of the other helicopters, and that one caught back up to the formation. So now there were only 7. One of the helicopters was not damaged, but it was having such trouble navigating. It was such an uncomfortable situation. There was a fear that the equipment was going to give out. They made the decision to turn back. Basically, as those helicopters are moving further and further into Iran, they reach a point of no return where either they have to press on and make it to the rendezvous point, or they have to turn around and go back, because if they go further, they're not going to have enough fuel to get back to the aircraft carrier. So as one of the 7 remaining helicopters approached that cutoff point, they made the decision, one for which they will always be criticized by other members of the mission, to turn back. And so that left just 6. 6 would have been enough, but because probably of the beating these helicopters took flying through these clouds, when those 6 helicopters made it to the rendezvous point, one of them had suffered such severe damage that the pilot decided that it couldn't go on. And so he made the decision as the captain of that vessel that it was that they couldn't fly it. That gave them only 5 helicopters, which was by their prearranged chart. That was an automatic abort.
And then there was a plane crash, just adding to the catastrophic nature of this.
Right. I mean, the first word that came back to the White House was very disappointing that they had decided to abort and they were going to come back out. But it wasn't catastrophic. And Carter, in fact, even said to his advisors in the White House how happy he was that at least no one had gotten hurt, and was also, I'm sure, aware that it was something that they could come back and try again. But in preparing the aircraft to evacuate and fly back out of Iran, one of the helicopters collided with one of the transport planes, blew up into flames. 8 men were killed. Debris from the exploding aircraft sent pieces of metal. There was a lot of ammunition on that plane. When it blew up, ammunition was cooking off. So it riddled the other aircraft with bullets and bits and pieces of metal. It's really a wonder that no one else other than those who were burned on the plane were hurt. But that made the whole effort a complete catastrophe at that point.
And there was certainly no way of keeping this event a secret anymore.
No more.
And it's kind of amazing that they got out after that.
Yeah, I mean, they regrouped very quickly. It just goes to show you how successfully they had achieved surprise. Because the Iranians, in fact, didn't even find out about what had happened in the desert until Carter made the announcement in Washington. And he made the announcement right away, alerting the Iranians and the world to this catastrophe in the desert. And in fact, in Iran, you know, they made an effort to characterize what had happened as an invasion of Iran, that the United States had tried to invade the country, when in fact, Carter made it clear in his statement that this was strictly a rescue mission, that there were strict instructions not to harm Iranians unless it was absolutely necessary. No Iranians had been hurt, because he wanted to make sure that it was understood exactly what the nature of this mission was.
My guest is Mark Bowden. His new book, Guests of the Ayatollah, is about the Iranian hostage crisis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Bowden. His new book, Guests of the Ayatollah, is about the Iranian hostage crisis. When we left off, we were talking about the failed military mission to rescue the American hostages. President Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, supported the rescue mission, but Secretary of State Cyrus Vance did not. He thought we should pursue negotiations instead. What was it like in the White House when they found out that the mission had failed and that, you know, people were killed? What were the conversations like deciding how to break the news? Who should break the news? What language should be used?
It was obviously funereal in the White House. I think, the mission had been a complete catastrophe. It was a huge roll of the dice, and so they knew obviously going in what a big risk they were taking. But they also knew both militarily and in terms of the fate of the hostages that it had potential to be, you know, a wonderful success and also sort of a real coup. I mean, to just be able to reach in this terrible dilemma which had afflicted the country for months and months and just solve the problem, like cut the knot. And it proved to be too good to be true. And so apart from the military losses and the real problem with what was going to happen now to the hostages was the political fallout. Everyone knew, you know, Carter had already increasingly been seen as an ineffectual president, an impotent president, as someone who was incapable of dealing with this crisis. And now, you know, this terrible tragedy meant that I think Hamilton Jordan felt at that moment that that was it for the next term. This was an election year, so there was, I think, a recognition that this was just a political disaster from which they would probably not recover. And I think that most of the conversation, and I don't know enough to know what all of it would have been, but I believe their primary concern was the fate of the hostages at that point, because the Iranians had threatened all along that they would begin executing the hostages if any military action was taken. So I think that the planning that went into the statement that was made was to make it very clear how limited this military thrust had been, how it had not hurt any Iranians, that the only people killed were the Americans on it. So it was humiliating to present it in that way, but it was done because in hopes of forestalling revenge against the hostages.
There's one sentence in the book where you describe how Hamilton Jordan, who was then the White House chief of staff, upon hearing the news of the failure of the rescue mission, goes into the president's bathroom and throws up. And in that one sentence, you kind of have a doorway into the kind of anxiety that people in the White House must have been feeling about this high-risk mission.
I mean, and Jordan, who in addition to being the chief of staff, was managing Carter's re-election campaign. And I think, you know, for him, the full nature of the catastrophe hit home very hard. I mean, his hopes were really dashed. And he had been someone who had advised Carter that it was time to do something and had felt strongly that as risky as this mission was, that it was really their only alternative at that point. So I think he really, you know, felt fully the brunt of the disaster. It's interesting that Brzezinski, who was always a bit more of a hardliner in these things than the other people around Carter, had advised the president before undertaking the mission to prepare military strikes on Iran in the event of its failure, because then the United States could say that the United States has struck Iran, you know, because of this hostage problem where, you know, the country is being punished for its behavior. And, you know, we lost some men in the desert as part of a rescue mission. So that, I mean, that's a classic example of spinning things so that it would be a small failure in what could be portrayed as a larger success. And Carter had not agreed to do that. I mean, he basically was putting all his eggs in this rescue effort.
Now, another thing that went wrong in this mission was that many of the secret documents outlining the mission and the thinking behind the mission were left with the abandoned helicopters.
Right.
And were they discovered by the Iranians?
They were, and they were eventually published by the Iranians. And in fact, in retrospect, it's probably a good thing that they were, because the Iranians, you know, were doing their best in the days after this failed mission to portray what happened as this massive American invasion of their country. And the existence of the actual mission plan, which had been left behind in the confusion and chaos of the Desert One after the explosion, made it clear to the Iranians exactly what was being attempted. And it made it very difficult for them to continue to portray it as something more than it actually was.
Mark Bowden will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called Guests of the Ayatollah. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. From GM, working to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions with vehicles that run on gasoline or E85 ethanol. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the negotiations after the failed rescue attempt. We continue our conversation with Mark Bowden about the Iranian hostage crisis. And TV critic David Bianculli recommends 3 DVD box sets from 3 different eras of television. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Bowden. He's best known for his book, Black Hawk Down. His new book, Guests of the Ayatollah, is about the Iranian hostage crisis, which he describes as the first battle in America's war with militant Islam. When we left off, we were talking about the failed military mission to rescue the hostages. After the failed rescue attempt, things could have gone terribly wrong. I mean, the hostages could have been executed. Iran could have thought of this as an attack against them and tried to take some kind of other retaliatory action against the United States. But eventually there was a negotiated settlement, and the hostages were released. Mm-hmm. But why did the negotiations pick up after the failed rescue attempt?
Well, actually, Terry, what happened was, and I describe it in the book as almost as though the rescue mission lanced a boil. I mean, this challenge to the United States seizing its embassy, holding its diplomats hostage, the threats of trial and execution, all the accusations toward the United States, this sort of humiliating process, which had dragged on for months, just seemed to mount and mount and mount through, you know, the early months of 1980. You know, there was, I think, an increasing feeling in this country that the United States had to do something. The media had a big hand in portraying this as the most critical issue in the world. And, you know, the White House, you know, was portrayed as being obsessed by it. And, you know, I really think that the press had a big role in building up the importance of this episode in Tehran until it got to the point where it seemed like something had to happen. And I think that the rescue mission was the something that happened. And when it failed, it took the pressure off in an odd way. And when I think two things happened. The mission failed and the Iranians backed down from their threat to begin killing the hostages in retaliation. And when those two things didn't happen, I think both sides just sort of retreated to their corners for a period of months. It got so in this country, in the United States, the publicity about the hostage crisis faded so much from the news that the hostage families were taking out billboards to remind people that there were still Americans being held hostage in Iran. Diplomatic efforts had been tried again and again, had repeatedly failed. The Ayatollah Khomeini had said that the issue of the hostages would be resolved by the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, which would not meet until sometime in June or July. So there was literally nothing to be done. There was certainly no possibility of another rescue attempt. For one thing, you know, the Iranians woke up, the students who were holding the hostages woke up to the obvious miscalculation of keeping them all in the same place. And so they dispersed the hostages all over the country, which made any attempt to rescue them completely impractical. What ultimately led to a diplomatic solution were a number of things. Probably the most important was the war with Iraq. Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, and suddenly Iran needed desperately military supplies, and most of their armed forces, if not all of it, had been supplied by the United States. So they needed parts, they needed equipment, they needed training. You know, there were all sorts of things that they desperately had to have, and the United States was really the only place they could get it.
So when both sides agreed to actually resume negotiations, who did the Carter White House negotiate with?
The initial contact was made by a man named Sadegh Tabatabai, who had been a minister in the provisional government. He was related by marriage to the Ayatollah Khomeini. Tabatabai was a very secular guy, a very pragmatic politician, and he could see how important it was going to be for Iran to resolve this problem. So he talked to the Ayatollah's son, who was his brother-in-law, and said, I think I can help solve this hostage problem, and made contacts through the German foreign ministry with the White House, and that's how the negotiations started.
And what was the final settlement? What did we give?
Ultimately, the United States gave Iran back the things that it had seized in retaliation for the takeover of the embassy. And it gave it a couple of other things. It indemnified Iran from lawsuits by the hostages and their families for the ordeal that they had been put through. But essentially it involved a transfer of money.
When the Iranians, how much money?
It ended up being about $6 billion. Uh-huh. And that's money that the Shah had deposited in the United States to pay for all these military contracts that didn't go away. You know, once the revolution happened, there was still this money in American bank accounts. It's actually a funny story about one of the hostages, Chuck Scott, who was an army colonel, who went to meet the man who is now the supreme leader of Iran, Khamenei, and told him that he wanted to reopen negotiations about the military contracts. And Khamenei, in the full feeling of the revolution, said, we don't need to talk to the United States anymore. There's nothing for us to talk about. And Scott said, okay, well, we'll take the $10 billion that you have deposited in American banks and just put it in the American Treasury then. And so, the reality was that they had to deal with the United States in order to get back what was really theirs.
The Iranians didn't want to release the hostages while President Carter was in the White House. So right after Reagan is sworn in and Carter flies out of Washington, word comes in, hostages have been released, and the newly elected president, Reagan, the newly sworn in president, gets to make that announcement, whereas Carter gets to mention it when he returns to Plains, Georgia.
Right.
What impression do you think that gave the American public about who was really responsible for the release of the hostages?
I think, it led to the suspicion that Reagan and Reagan's people had somehow been involved, which they were not. And I think that even, the Iranians made the decision to release the hostages when Carter was out of office as a final insult to him. The deal had been struck weeks earlier, and they could easily have been released. And Carter, I think, right up until sitting on the inaugural stand that day, had hopes that the release would be done and he would be able to fly to Wiesbaden and greet the hostages as his final act as president. After all, this is the thing that had destroyed his presidency.
My guest is Mark Bowden. His new book, Guests of the Ayatollah, is about the Iranian hostage crisis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Bowden. He's best known for his book, Black Hawk Down. His new book is called Guests of the Ayatollah, The First Battle in America's War with Militant Islam. And it's all about the Iranian hostage crisis from every angle. In your book, you're kind of critical of the world community. You think that other Western nations could have done more, could have done something to help the United States during the hostage crisis. What do you think they could have done?
Well, I think concerted international pressure was the only realistic option for freeing the hostages. And I see, the seizure of an embassy as an insult not just against the United States, but against the international community. The UN exists as a body dedicated to the importance of diplomacy. And if diplomats can be held hostage, it pretty much destroys any possibility of normal formal intercourse going on between nations. So, here was a body dedicated to the concept of diplomacy essentially turning its back. They did issue pronouncements condemning it, but they took no action. And I think that they should have.
You're more interested in storytelling than in political analysis. But I still want to ask you, having done this really in-depth investigation into the Iranian hostage crisis, what you think now of how President Carter handled it?
I think that he handled it very, very well, personally. I think it was an impossible position for a president to be in. I think those who believe he should have responded more aggressively right when it happened fail to understand the limitations of the options available to him. I think that it's also important to look back at the circumstances in the broader context of that period, the Cold War, the fact that the Soviet Union was still a very significant threat, in fact, invaded Afghanistan during the course of this crisis, the potential for igniting a nuclear war, which was, I think, a very real fear at the time. I think when you take all those things into consideration, President Carter was put into a position that very few people could have found no one could have found an easy answer to. It's always possible that if he had issued an ultimatum that the Iranians would have backed down, but given the fervor of their emotions as a country at that moment, I kind of doubt it.
You know, your book is subtitled The First Battle in America's War with Militant Islam. Do you think that the Carter White House or that the leaders of the military saw it that way? Had any idea that this was the first in what was going to be a long battle with militant Islam?
I don't think so. I think that that only came into focus, certainly for me, after 9/11. I knew prior to the attacks on this country by al-Qaeda that the United States was heading toward a confrontation with Islamic fundamentalism around the world. But I think when this happened in 1979, and even in the years afterwards, it was seen as a kind of an aberrant event. Iran had gone a little crazy, with its revolution. And I don't think very many people saw that this was really the first strike in what has become an international movement against the United States and the Western world.
What role, if any, as far as you can tell from your research, did the current Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, have in the Iranian hostage crisis?
Well, Ahmadinejad was a very prominent radical student during the revolutionary period, and he was a right-winger, a fundamentalist, an Islamist fundamentalist. And he, along with four other students, had formed an organization called Strengthen the Unity, which was an effort to unite the various Muslim student factions at Tehran's universities into a single entity, because they were contending, really, for the future of Iran with communists, nationalists, socialists, secular groups who had a lot of influence. This group, Strengthen the Unity, which consisted of five students, came up with the idea of seizing the embassy. Ahmadinejad initially, for tactical reasons, argued against taking the American embassy. He thought that taking the Soviet embassy would be a smarter move. He was outvoted, and he has said since that he retained his opposition to the takeover of the embassy until the Ayatollah Khomeini endorsed it, which happened on the day of the takeover. So by my figuring, he opposed the takeover of the American embassy for about 2 or 3 days and was one of the key players in everything that happened after the embassy was seized.
So we have somebody who was a key figure in the Iranian hostage crisis now heading Iran as Iran enters its nuclear age.
Yes, and I see a very strong parallel to what was going on in 1979 and what's happening today. Because in 1979, the future of Iran as an Islamist state was not by any means secure. There were very strong secular political figures in that country who wanted to form something more of a democracy. The seizure of the American embassy essentially created this big foreign threat. It turns out, I think, it was an imaginary foreign threat, but it rallied the popular support behind the mullahs. And essentially, the most important consequence of the takeover of the American embassy was in Iran, and it leveraged the mullahs into power, again, by identifying this terrible foreign threat and by uniting people behind the mullahs who were seen as the people who could deal with it or were willing to deal with it. This is exactly what's happening today. You have Ahmadinejad now, the elected president of Iran. Now, he was elected only after candidates who were not acceptable to the mullahs were eliminated from the ballot. But he has successfully seized upon this nuclear issue, again, picking a fight with the United States of America, because it's a very popular one in Iran. Most Iranians, even those who are not terribly enthusiastic about the mullahs and the current regime, feel that Iran has every right to have nuclear energy or even nuclear weapons. And in fact, they live in a part of the world where they're threatened on all sides by nuclear power. So it's a popular issue, and I think he's riding the mullahs back into a measure of popularity that they'd lost.
Do you see any other parallels between the Iranian hostage crisis and what's happening today?
Well, I think that the United States is similarly in a bind because while the Bush administration has made a point of saying that military options are still on the table, I don't really think there are too many practical military options available to the president, other than short of basically going to war against Iran, which I don't believe anyone believes would be a good idea. So in that sense, I believe that Ahmadinejad and the ruling regime in Iran has very shrewdly chosen an issue where they can sort of build national pride, rally national pride behind the mullahs, and there's very little that the United States can do. The other part of it is the United States is once again will have to depend on the international community and the UN to apply any real pressure to Iran. And given what happened 25 years ago, I frankly am skeptical that any of that will come to bear.
Is there any one thing you can point to in the story of the Iranian hostage crisis that you see completely differently now that you've done the research for your book than you did before?
I can definitely see much better than I ever could how and why the Iranian students did what they did. I think that having lived through that episode and read about it and watched reporting on television, I think probably the most I got out of it, and probably a lot of that is my fault for not having done enough work on it, but was that there was just these people in Iran were kind of crazy. That there was this spasm of irrational behavior out of Iran. And in fact, if you look at the history of American involvement in Iran, if you look at even just the lifetimes of the students who were involved in the takeover of the embassy, they had very good reasons to fear the United States. And it turns out, in my opinion, the fears that they had were unfounded. But I don't fault them for suspecting the United States of trying to destroy the revolution, of suspecting the diplomats in that embassy of having been spies and of having been plotting. I do think that at a certain point it should have dawned on them that that was not true, but I don't think that what they did was in any way irrational.
Because the United States had overthrown the first democratically elected leader of Iran not too long before the hostage crisis.
Right. I mean, and the justification for that would have been sort of Cold War logic, you know, that it was more important to the United States that we retain a strong ally in Iran, that we have access to oil in Iran. These were overriding national security interests. And so, you know, the freedom and the independence of the people of Iran got very short shrift in that calculation. And I think what was done was wrong in retrospect. I think it parallels the behavior of the United States throughout that part of the world during the Cold War. And in this war against Islamic fundamentalism, we are reaping seeds that we sowed, you know, 25, 30 years ago when our only priority was this contest against the Soviet Union. And the caution there, I think, to us as a country ought to be to realize the importance of respecting the individuality of nations, the moral imperative of their independence. And I certainly think that any time the United States is involved in overthrowing an elected government in order to put a king on the throne is something that I would just instinctively be against, regardless of what the exact political calculus was at that moment.
Well, Mark Bowden, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Mark Bowden's new book is called Guests of the Ayatollah. You can read his article about the failed rescue attempt in the current edition of The Atlantic magazine, where he's a national correspondent. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews DVD box sets of three TV shows from three different eras. This is Fresh Air. Our TV critic David Bianculli watches a lot of TV, of course, and lately more and more DVDs. He likes the way DVDs enable you to see the span of television from its beginnings to today.
Every time I stack up a new batch of DVD box sets to watch and review, I'm amazed by what a perfect way to watch TV this is. But the longer the TV series on DVD are out there, and remember, it's only been about 8 years, the more astounding the selection gets. So what I'm doing today is highlighting three box sets from three completely different eras of television. One is a sitcom from the dawn of TV time. Another collects excerpts from talk show interviews spanning the 1960s through the 1980s. And one is pretty much brand new, the final season of a fabulous drama series from HBO. Individually, they're entertaining, instructive, and valuable. Collectively, they're a tour through the history and evolution of television. Three different genres stretching the boundaries of a still-stretching medium. The oldest oldie goldie is Mr. Peepers, a show that ran on NBC from 1952 to 1956. It starred Wally Cox as a high school science teacher, and fellow cast members included Marion Lorne, who later played Aunt Clara on Bewitched, as well as Jack Warden, and, in his first major TV role, Tony Randall. The show Mr. Peepers, like its star, was quiet and unassuming. It was performed live and exists only on kinescope, the process by which live performances were recorded using a camera aimed at a TV monitor while the show was in progress. The images and the sound are grainy and scratchy, but it's a wonder they exist at all. The first 26 episodes from the UCLA Film and TV Archive have been released in a 4-DVD set from Samore Entertainment. To fans of old TV, this is like finding a fish fossil with legs. These have never been released on DVD or VHS before. Here's the opening of a typical 1952 show, with Cox at his school desk, trying but failing to swat a fly as he greets the TV audience.
Mr. Peepers, starring Wally Cox.
Oh, hello, everybody. I'm Robinson Peepers. I'm the general science teacher here at Jefferson Junior High. This is my science classroom where I work. I've been here for 8 weeks now. My salary is $43 a week.
The second DVD set pulls interviews from The Merv Griffin Show, which aired in syndication off and on between 1965 and 1986. Here's the way he introduces his 1985 interview with Orson Welles, who had just celebrated his 70th birthday. Welles, Merv explained, had been on his show 40 times, always with the same rules. There were no pre-interviews because he wanted the conversations to be spontaneous. And there was to be no talking about the past, ever. No questions about Citizen Kane or his wife Rita Hayworth or anything else that wasn't looking forward.
And so came this interview on a certain night. When he walked into our studio and asked to see me, I never saw Orson Welles before our interviews or after. Occasionally a luncheon, but not on the day of the show. I came down, and there was Orson standing at my dressing room door, and he said, "Merv, tonight I feel very expansive. All those little gossipy questions you want to ask me about Marlena and Rita and, the making of Citizen Kane, ask them tonight. I'd like to answer." Well, I was stunned, because that's what I always wanted to talk to him about. And thus the tape you're about to see. The tragedy of this tape you're about to see is that 2 hours after he did this interview, he died. Here's Orson Welles on his very last appearance anywhere.
If that doesn't make you want to hear the interview, you have no curiosity whatsoever. Finally, there's the fifth season package of HBO's 6 Feet Under. What I love about this show, more than anything else, is the way it ended. Its finale was one of the all-time best endings of a TV show. And in this collection, series creator Alan Ball, who wrote and directed that expanded last episode, offers an audio commentary that explains it all. The clip I'm about to play, in case you don't want to hear it, is the very start of that brilliant closing sequence, when Lauren Ambrose, as Claire, drives away in her hybrid car, leaving her family behind as she quite literally drives towards her future. Here's the way Alan Ball speaks about it as the scene is rolling.
Claire's being good, driving a hybrid car, and putting Ted's deeply unhip mix, which of course is incredibly hip. I wanted to keep them out of focus in this scene right there as they're waving on the porch because they're already receding in memory, just like him in the rearview mirror. I can't remember who in the writer's room came up early in the season with the idea of seeing everyone's death, but I remember when I heard that, I was like, yeah, of course.
These audio commentary tracks are like a graduate course in TV production and in TV appreciation. If you loved 6 Feet Under, you have to get this HBO video release. But if you never saw the show, don't dare start here. Start with season 1 and work your way back up. Or if you want, work your way way back to Merv Griffin and to Mr. Peepers. There's plenty of good old TV to go around for everybody.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Play to the End, a novel of psychological suspense by Robert Goddard, author of Hand in Glove. From BMW, where ideas are everything. And as an independent company, they have the freedom to let those ideas live on. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. And from Turner Classic Movies, presenting Race and Hollywood, Black Images on Film, a 38-film retrospective with discussion and commentary Tuesday and Thursday nights in May. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Clark Kent Irvin, former Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. He says the department remains a collection of dysfunctional components. He's written a new book called Open Target, where America is vulnerable to attack. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.